Chapter 21. Being usually favored in that respect, but on this occasion it gave me great uneasiness. As soon as we were out of doors, Egbert, with the manner of a little footpad, demanded a shilling of me on the ground that his pocket money was bone from him. On my pointing out the great impropriety of the word, especially in connection with his parent, for he added sulkily by her, comma, he pinched me and said, "Oh, then. Now, who are you? You wouldn't like it, I think. What does she make a sham for, and pretend to give me money, and take it away again? Why do you call it my allowance, and never let me spend it?" These exasperating questions so inflamed his mind, and the minds of Oswald and Francis, that they all pinched me at once, and in a dreadfully expert way screwing up such little pieces of my arms, that I could hardly forbear crying out. Felix, at the same time, stamped upon my toes. And the bond of Joy, who on account of always having the whole of his little income anticipated stood in fact pledged to abstain from cakes as well as tobacco, so swelled with grief and rage, when we passed a pastry cook's shop, that he terrified me by becoming purple. I never underwent so much, both in body and mind, in the course of a walk with young people, as from these unnaturally constrained children, when they paid me the compliment of being natural. I was glad when we came to the brickmaker's house, though it was one of a cluster of wretched hovels in a brick field, with pixies close to the broken windows, and miserable little gardens before the doors growing nothing but stagnant pools. Here and there an old tub was put to catch the droppings of rainwater from a roof, or they were banked up with mud into a little pond like a large dirt pie. At the doors and windows some men and women lounged or prowled about, and took little notice of us except to laugh to one another, or to say something as we passed about gentle folks minding their own business, and not troubling their heads and muddying their shoes with coming, to look after other people's. Mrs. Pardiggle, leading the way with a great show of moral determination and talking with much volubility about the untidy habits of the people, though I doubted if the best of us could have been tidy in such a place, conducted us into a cottage at the farthest corner, the ground floor room of which we nearly filled. Besides ourselves, there were in this damp, offensive room a woman with a black eye, nursing a poor little gasping baby by the fire. A man, all stained with clay and mud and looking very dissipated, lying at full length on the ground, smoking a pipe, a powerful young man fastening a collar on a dog, and a bold girl doing some kind of washing in very dirty water. They all looked up at us as we came in, and the woman seemed to turn her face towards the fire, as if to hide her bruised eye. Nobody gave us any welcome. "Well, my friends," said Mrs. Pardiggle, but her voice had not a friendly sound, I thought. It was much too businesslike and systematic. "How do you do, all of you? I am here again. I told you, you couldn't tire me, you know. I am fond of hard work, and am true to my word." "There, aunt," growled the man on the floor, whose head rested on his hand as he stared at us, "any more on you to come in, is there?" "No, my friend," said Mrs. Pardiggle, seating herself on one stool and knocking down another. "We are all here." "Because I thought there weren't enough of you, perhaps?" said the man, with his pipe between his lips as he looked round upon us. The young man and the girl both laughed. Two friends of the young man, whom we had attracted to the doorway, and who stood there with their hands in their pockets, echoed the laugh noisily. "You can't tire me, good people," said Mrs. Pardiggle to these latter. "I enjoy hard work, and the harder you make mine, the better I like it." "Then make it easy for her," growled the man upon the floor. "I wants it done, and over. I wants a end of these liberties, took with my place. I wants an end of being drawed like a badger. Now you're a-going to poll, pry, and question according to custom. I know what you're a-going to be up to. Well, you haven't got no occasion to be up to it. I'll save you the trouble. Is my daughter a-washin'?" "Yes, she is a-washin'. Look at the water. Smell it. That's what we drinks. How do you like it, and what do you think of gin instead? And my place dirty? Yes, it is dirty, it's naturally dirty, and it's naturally unwholesome. And we've had 5 dirty and unwholesome children, as is all dead infants, and so much the better for them, and for us besides. Have I read the little book What You Left? No, I ain't read the little book What You Left. There ain't nobody here as knows how to read it, and if there was, it wouldn't be suitable to me. It's a book fit for a babby, and I'm not a babby. If he was to leave me a doll, I shouldn't miss it. How have I been conducting of myself? Why, I've been drunk for 3 days, and it'd have been drunk for, if it had the money. Don't I never mean for to go to church? No, I don't never mean for to go to church. I shouldn't be expected there, if I did. The Beatles too genteel for me. And how did my wife get that black eye? Why, I give it her. And if she says I didn't, she's a lie. He had pulled his pipe out of his mouth to say all this, and he now turned over on his other side and smoked again. Mrs. Pardiggle, who had been regarding him through her spectacles with a forcible composure, calculated, I could not help thinking, to increase his antagonism, pulled out a good book, as if it were a constable's staff, and took the whole family into custody. I mean into religious custody, of course. But she really did it, as if she were an inexorable moral policeman carrying them all off to a station house. Ada and I were very uncomfortable. We both felt intrusive, and out of place, and we both thought that Mrs. Pardiggle would have got on infinitely better if she had not had such a mechanical way of taking possession of people. The children sulked and stared. The family took no notice of us whatever, except when the young man made the dog bark, which he usually did, when Mrs. Pardiggle was most emphatic. We both felt painfully sensible that between us and these people there was an iron barrier which could not be removed by our new friend. By whom or how it could be removed, we did not know, but we knew that. Even what she read and said seemed to us to be ill-chosen for such auditors, if it had been imparted ever so modestly and with ever so much tact. As to the little book to which the man on the floor had referred, we acquired a knowledge of it afterwards, and Mr. Jarndyce said he doubted if Robinson Crusoe could have read it, though he had had no other on his desolate island. We were much relieved, under these circumstances, when Mrs. Pardiggle left off. The man on the floor, then turning his bead round again, said morosely, Well, you've done, have you? For today, I have, my friend. But I am never fatigued. I shall come to you again in your regular order, returned Mrs. Pardiggle with demonstrative cheerfulness. So long as you goes now, said he, folding his arms and shutting his eyes with an oath, you may do what you like. Mrs. Pardiggle accordingly rose, and made a little vortex in the confined room from which the pipe itself very narrowly escaped. Taking one of her young family in each hand, and telling the others to follow closely, and expressing her hope that the brickmaker and all his house would be improved, when she saw them next, she then proceeded to another cottage. I hope it is not unkind in me to say that she certainly did make, in this as in everything else, a show that was not conciliatory of doing charity by wholesale, and of dealing in it to a large extent. She supposed that we were following her, but as soon as the space was left clear, we approached the woman sitting by the fire to ask if the baby were ill. She only looked at it as it lay on her lap. We had observed before that, when she looked at it, she covered her discolored eye with her hand, as though she wished to separate any association with noise and violence, and ill treatment from the poor little child. Ada, whose gentle heart was moved by its appearance, bent down to touch its little face. As she did so, I saw what happened, and drew her back. The child died. Oh, Esther! Cried Ada, sinking on her knees beside it. Look here. Oh, Esther, my love, the little thing. The suffering, quiet, pretty little thing. I am so sorry for it. I am so sorry for the mother. I never saw a sight so pitiful as this before. Oh, baby, baby. Such compassion, such gentleness, as that with which she bent down weeping and put her hand upon the mother's might have softened any mother's heart that ever beat. The woman at first gazed at her in astonishment, and then burst into tears. Presently I took the light burden from her lap, did what I could to make the baby's rest the prettier and gentler, laid it on a shelf, uncovered it with my own handkerchief. We tried to comfort the mother, and we whispered to her what our Savior said of children. She answered nothing, but sat weeping, weeping very much. When I turned, I found that the young man had taken out the dog, and was standing at the door looking in upon us with dry eyes, but quiet. The girl was quiet too, and sat in a corner looking on the ground. The man had risen. He still smoked his pipe with an air of defiance, but he was silent. An ugly woman, very poorly clothed, hurried in while I was glancing at them, and coming straight up to the mother, said, "Jenny, Jenny." The mother rose on being so addressed, and fell upon the woman's neck. She also had upon her face and arms the marks of ill usage. She had no kind of grace about her, but the grace of sympathy. But when she condoled with the woman, and her own tears fell, she wanted no beauty. I say condoled, but her only words were, "Jenny, Jenny." All the rest was in the tone in which she said them. I thought it very touching, to see these two women, coarse and shabby and beaten, so united, to see what they could be to one another, to see how they felt for one another, how the heart of each to each was softened by the hard trials of their lives. I think the best side of such people is almost hidden from us. What the poor are to the poor is little known, excepting to themselves and God. We felt it better to withdraw and leave them uninterrupted. We stole out quietly, and without notice from anyone except the man. He was leaning against the wall near the door, and finding that there was scarcely room for us to pass, went out before us. He seemed to want to hide that he did this on our account, but we perceived that he did, and thanked him. He made no answer. Otto was so full of grief all the way home, and Richard, whom we found at home, was so distressed to see her in tears, though he said to me, when she was not present, how beautiful it was to comma that we arranged to return at night with some little comforts and repeat our visit at the brickmaker's house. We said as little as we could to Mr. Jarndyce, but the wind changed directly. Richard accompanied us at night to the scene of our morning expedition. On our way there, we had to pass a noisy drinking house, where a number of men were flocking about the door. Among them, and prominent in some dispute, was the father of the little child. At a short distance, we passed the young man and the dog, in congenial company. The sister was standing laughing and talking with some other young women at the corner of the row of cottages, but she seemed ashamed and turned away as we went by. We left our escort within sight of the brickmaker's dwelling, and proceeded by ourselves. When we came to the door, we found the woman who had brought such consolation with her standing there looking anxiously out. "It's you, young ladies, is it?" she said in a whisper. "I'm a watching for my master. My heart's in my mouth. If he was to catch me away from home, he'd pretty near murder me."
"Do you mean your husband?"
said one. "Yes, miss, my master. Jenny's asleep, quite worn out. She's scarcely had the child off her lap, poor thing, these 7 days and nights, except when I've been able to take it for a minute or two." As she gave way for us, she went softly in and put what we had brought near the miserable bed on which the mother slept. No effort had been made to clean the room. It seemed in its nature almost hopeless of being clean. But the small waxen form from which so much solemnity diffused itself had been composed afresh, and washed, and neatly dressed in some fragments of white linen, and on my handkerchief, which still covered the poor baby, a little bunch of sweet herbs had been laid by the same rough, scarred hands, so lightly, so tenderly. "May heaven reward you," we said to her. "You are a good woman."
"Me, young ladies?" she returned with surprise.
"Hush! Jenny, Jenny!" The mother had moaned in her sleep and moved.
The sound of the familiar voice seemed to calm her again. She was quiet once more. How little I thought, when I raised my handkerchief, to look upon the tiny sleeper underneath, and seemed to see a halo shine around the child through Ada's drooping hair as her pity bent her head, how little I thought in whose unquiet bosom that handkerchief would come to lie, after covering the motionless and peaceful breast. I only thought that perhaps the angel of the child might not be all unconscious of the woman who replaced it with so compassionate a hand. Not all unconscious of her presently, when we had taken leave, and left her at the door, by turns looking, and listening in terror for herself, and saying in her old soothing manner, Jenny, Jenny. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.